hobby and how to create understanding. And I also saw this weekend a brand new wireless device. I mean, we amateur radio operators just love wireless and radio and what all it can do. And there are roughly 20 kinds of wireless devices the public is using right now, and they don't even know it. I'm talking about your remote control for the hand-operated thing that does the unlocking of your automobile, the garage door opener, your cellular phone, your wireless phone, your pagers that we used to use, lots and lots of, a lot of us are using a wireless mouse, a wireless keyboard, some of us a wireless display, we want to hold on to it, everything in our house we want to be wireless. It's a brand new wireless thing that I saw that amazed the hell out of me. Let me drop a comment. I heard somebody say comment, get back to you in a minute. The brand new wireless thing that I saw is that while all this tree service was going on at my neighbor's house, and they were running about five pieces of machinery simultaneously, guys up the trees with tree saws, cherry pickers, a truck with a very fancy crane on the back that picks up these great big logs and puts it into the truck, a device out front that's making wood chips out of the branches, and a guy running around with a cat-like machine. He walks behind it, and it's got a great big claw in the front, and it picks up these great big heavy logs and shifts them around the property. But the guy who came along with the root grinder, man, was that one hell of a machine. This thing probably has 50 or 100 horsepower to it, a great big wheel in the front that does an extremely fast job of taking an 80-foot-high tree, and there were about seven of them were cut down on the property. Seven trees 60 to 80 feet high were cut down, and then they use this root grinder. The root grinder is a radio-controlled device. The guy stands off to one side, and by using the controls on the radio control, he makes his root grinder walk around the property, walk over to where the stump is, and he's controlling it, waving back and forth. He's controlling it up and down. He's controlling the turning of the steering of the thing and whether or not it progresses forward or reverse. He's doing that all by remote control. A wireless device with tremendous power to it. If that thing started coming towards you and started chopping a hole in the house, my goodness, can that thing do damage? Another wireless device amazed the hell out of me. Who was it that wanted to make a comment? KQRIW.
Good evening, Dick and Annette. Call sign is W02Z. The name is Ian in the Alpha November.
Okay, I know it's Ian, but the A2Z is what it sounds like. You said it so fast. Was the Alpha 2 Zulu? Is that Ian? Go right ahead, Ian.
It's Whiskey Ocean to Zulu, Dick, and good night to you and Annette. Just a quick comment regarding the fuels. I purchased, during the storm, I purchased a Honda generator, and I was talking to the guy the other day at John Deere, and he's on Old Country Road, I think in Hicksville or Westbury, one of the two, but during the storm, he probably brought a couple of tractor trailers of generators to Long Island, and I'd venture to say there's probably maybe 1,000 extra Honda generators now as a result of the storm. Long story short, though, he did tell me that Honda, and I guess they looked at what happened in the Northeast, are in the process of developing a device that will allow the generator to run on an alternate source of fuel. And I know there are devices available that will do that, but I guess maybe to the purist that owns a Honda generator, it's probably good news that they may develop something that could be retrofitted to just a gasoline generator.
Don't get into news, Ian. So we've had enough experience now by way of Superstorm Sandy that when it comes to various ways of getting standby power for gas stations, homes, cell sites, and whatever, an amazing number of cell sites had batteries that are good for a few hours and then they failed. So an amazing number of cell sites became inoperative unless the company had the resources to bring in a cow. What does that stand for now? A cell on wheels, I guess is what COW stands for. So except for some of these backup procedures, an amazing amount of the communication in this system did fail during Hurricane Gloria. Here we go, Hurricane Sandy, Superstorm Sandy. I know we've kept you waiting an awful long time, Freddie. If you're still there, KB2, Victor, Bravo, November. net. And the fact that we took much too long with some of these exciting subjects, sorry about that. And Freddie, if you come back next week, you're going to be number one on the runway. John, let's go over to the mailbag, even though we spent much too much time on some of these things. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Hey, Dick.
Who was that that said, hey, Dick? Was that you, Eric?
Yeah, I got a question for you.
Go ahead with your question for me, Eric. Eric goes to the top of the list. He's the guy that maintains all this equipment you're listening to. Go ahead. One of the main guys. Go ahead, Eric.
Oh, by the way, we're operating on 900 now. If you want to tune in the receiver, you can hear yourself. I have a question for you. I have six cavities of Santec. Okay, the 4-inch cavities, they're really for between 800 and 900. Now, they're just Santec. And what I'm thinking about doing is creating notch with them. Okay, and as you well know, to create an upper notch, you take an inductor and put that across it. And if you want to make a lower notch, you take a capacitor and put that across it. You with me so far?
I know what you're talking about, and if you go to the Special Communications Techniques, an old book of ARRL, which talks about websites, I mean, about repeaters, and all how to homebrew the hardware, like how to homebrew your own duplexing filter system for a repeater. In that ARRL book, they go into quite a bit of the details of what you're talking about. But I'm on the page with you. Just right ahead, Eric. K2EJ, K2LIW.
Okay, so these Santec filters, the Santec, the way they're constructed, you can't just sort of dig into them, so to speak. So what I'm thinking of doing is this. For the upper notch, kind of put T's on the input and output. And by adjusting the length of a piece of coax that goes between the center connectors of the T's, I should be able to control the frequency of the notch. Agree with that?
Yes, I do, with certain limitations. By way of a stub tuner, is what you're describing. Let's see now. A quarter wave short circuit stub, half quarter wave open circuit stub. Quarter wave open circuit stub is going to create the notch for you. And you want that notch to be as close to the filter as possible. As that notch gets further and further away from the filter, I think the quality of the notch on the bandpass of the filter is going to not behave the way you want it to. You're trying to create an extremely high Q transmission circuit between that notch generator and the filter itself. So you want that notch to be, the thing that creates that notch to be as close to the output connector or input connector, I'm not sure which, of the filter itself. And should you put one on each is an interesting question. So what we're talking about here is an ordinary cavity filter, bandpass filter, when swept on a vector network analyzer, gives you a Gaussian-like curve. And by putting this extra element in the system, an extra capacitor or inductor, right after the peak of the bandpass, you can create an extremely deep notch when you do it correctly. And you need a cascading of those notches to make a duplexing filter. The duplexing filter is looking for, in the best of all worlds, 120 decibels of rejection on the transmit frequency on the receiver port. 600 KCOA in the case of 2 meters, you want to make a notch that is 120 dB down if you can get it to make sure that your transmitter does not overload your receiver when they're both connected to the same repeater antenna. That's where Eric is going. And so with that caveat, I agree with you so far, Eric. KE2EJ, K2LIW.
Okay, well, I'm a lucky guy because I got 20 megahertz in the part. Yeah, these bandpass filters are not terribly high here because they're designed for commercial flavor. There's 40 megahertz between the transmit and receive frequencies. So So when you look at the gist of the bandpass filter, the bandpass is something like almost a megahertz wide to start with. So I did a few experiments. Actually, as opposed to doing quarter wave stubs, I've made two imaginary quarter wave stubs by simply taking a short piece of coax and going between the two connectors. And that seems to work. And then when you cascade them, when they're right on top of each other, I don't know if I can get 110 dB. I think most duplexes only do about 90, when you get to that. I think I could be in pretty good shape.
So he said you're putting the stub in between the two connectors. Now, in the case of a usual duplexing filter, four or six cavities, you've got three loops on the transmit side and three loops on the receiver side, loops of coaxial cable of a specific length going in between the cavities, the output connector of cavity number one into the input connector of cavity number two. And in that loop is where I think you're putting this match filter in order to make a homebrew duplexing filter as opposed to climbing inside. In other words, you'd rather not open up the actual resonator itself. It's got beautiful silver plating and nicely weatherproofed and whatever. And I think you'd rather not climb inside of the real cavity filter in order to put in the usual reactor that's used for this notching function. Is that sort of what you're saying, Eric? K2EJ, K2LIW?
Yeah, that's exactly what I'm saying, Dave. I mean, if you look at the construction part that's in the AOLL handbook, you'll find that their inductor is simply a piece of wire that connects between the input and output connector of the cavity itself. I've always questioned, how do you adjust that?
In some cases, when they do put in a capacitor across one of the tuning loops, input or output, the pickup loop within the inductive coupling of some kinds of cavities, there is a variable capacitor they put in there. In the case of that piece of wire, to make it a variable inductance, there's an exact amount of inductance you want in order for the notch to fall at the exact frequency. You've got to find some way of tuning it. You could put a very small hole in the side. Waveguide beyond cutoff wouldn't disturb the filter performance, by which you can move that piece of wire around. I don't think you want to go that way. Let me get into this one, Eric. You don't want to open up the cavity itself and put in the usual variable capacitor on the loops. Well, I guess there's got to be a variable inductor. In the case of a variable inductor, yeah, you can squeeze it and stretch it in order to change the amount of inductance and change the way it lies. But then I would worry, I'd lose a lot of sleep over the fact that if it was a inductor that I tuned that way as a function of temperature and aging, is it going to move and give me some grief? You want that notch to fall on an extremely exact frequency, if you know what I mean. So this is not an easy one, Eric. You've got a difficult task here. And for a man of your resources, I think you could go out and buy the duplexing filter. But I know, like me, you want to do it homebrew if at all possible. That's a big learning curve. K2EJ, K2LIW in the TechNet.
All right, well, yeah, I am trying to save quite some money. I mean, I've got a six-cavity filter, which was designed actually with a bandpass filter to the receiver. But it kind of works. But when I did do it, one of my experiments, I had a couple of trombones. And I put the trombones in between them. And of course, as I adjust the trombone, you watch the knots move up and down. You know, it doesn't have to be, it can be any multiple of a quarter wave. It doesn't have to be the first quarter wave either.
I agree. But still, in the case of the trombone between the two, as a testing procedure to learn out what's going on, it tells you a lot, but any real trombone has sliding contacts in there. Even if they're beautiful, brand new, and silver plated, it's got definite limitations in its longevity of tuning. Of course, I know you're only doing this as an experiment. It's not something you're going to leave in there permanently. But a real, properly designed duplexing filter has exact lengths of those loops between the cavities, exact extra inductors or capacitors inside the cavity on the pickup loops, and those carefully tune those notches. They try to create a notch on the high side on the receivers and a notch on the low side on the transmitter. I might have it backwards, but you know what I mean. And so it's a real art and science to learn how to do that and to make it work right. So I hope that these articles you and I can read in the Specialized Communication Techniques Manual of ARRL will help. I'll bet you there are some websites on the case of homebrewing filters. Guarantee there are some websites where certain ham clubs have done that and they're maintaining it and they've gone through some of these learning curves. So there's got to be a lot of knowledge out there as to how to do it, Eric. And I've never done it. You're asking me as if I've got a lot of smart and experience on this one. I don't. I watch the guys at the AIL Amateur Radio Club with their homebrew duplexing filter. I watch them from time to time. 145.21, I think, no, 145.29 was the frequency when it was in operation. I watch them from time to time go through the process of refurbishing and maintaining that duplexing filter, and it was a bit of a pain. So homebrew duplexing filters, if it's not done with extreme care, can give you a lot of downrange grief. KE2EJ, K2LIW in the Tech Mask.
I'm taking one more place. Let's just now assume that I've created a notch by using a length of coax. I've trimmed it precisely to the frequency that I want. Now, assuming we're going to do that, what kind of coax would you use that would have the least variability in terms of temperature? KQRIWK3K.
I think I see where you're going here. Your duplexing filter is going to be at a remote site, which is not necessarily controlled in temperature. If it's inside of the housing where the tower is located, I'd like to believe it's controlled in temperature and humidity and so on. And so in order to get the highest possible performance out of a stub tuner, you want the coax cable of the stub to have the lowest possible loss. The Q of the stub is very dependent on the insertion loss of the cable. So I would like that stub to be made out of at least a high-quality hardline, and that's it, high-quality hardline. In the case of the open circuit portion of the stub, if that's what you're doing, yeah, quarter-wave open circuit is the best way to do it. I would put some kind of an end cap over the open circuit end to make sure that moisture and other things can't get in there, to make sure that it maintains itself. In fact, in the case of the quarter-wave open circuit stub, if you make it a little bit shorter than required and put a very high-quality variable capacitor at the end, maybe a piston-like capacitor, and maybe the end cap really is like the end cap of a copper piece of tubing with the variable capacitor, a piston variable capacitor installed there, that would allow you to do some very exact tuning. You don't want to be chopping off that notch with a file in order to try to get it to the right frequency. Variable tuning is the right way to do it. So I would do it with hardline, end cap, high quality end cap, weatherproofed, and a piston variable capacitor at the end of it. Over to you, Eric, K2LIW and the Tech Man.
All right, well, that's kind of my thinking. I mean, if you look at the, say, a Wacom duplexer on 2 meters, they make a nice four-cavity duplexer. The actual quarter-wave stub for the reject is actually a piece of copper pipe with a spider mount semiconductor in it, and it's actually slightly too long, and they use the capacitor to shorten it a little bit.
Okay, let me think about that. Too long means that it's inductive. The capacitance at the end sounds right. Sounds like the right direction. Whereas if you make it a little bit too short, the capacitor on the end lengthens it. Crazy system. Yep. So, something's wrong. If it's too short, you tune it with a capacitor. If it's too long, I'm having trouble believing you tune it with a capacitor.
That backwards, it's too short.
Okay, now we're on the same page. Okay. And to build it out of copper tubing with a spider support for the semiconductor, you're really building extremely low loss air line when you do that. And now you've fulfilled the requirement. You want the highest possible Q of that stub, which means the lowest possible insertion loss, and we're on the right page. I think you're going down the right path, Eric. I think it's going to work. KE2EJ, K2LIW in the tech head.
Well, that's only one half. The other half, of course, is on the receive. Don't forget, you need a notch above in one group, you need a notch below. And the notch below is going to be capacity. And again, I have tried just doing it as an open step. What I did try was putting the capacity between the semiconductors at the input and output of the cavity, and that seems a little fun. Where would you go with that, Dick?
In the case of a stub that is exactly a quarter wavelength long electronically, open circuit at one end, it gives you a beautiful short circuit notch at the other end, at the end where the key is located. The magic of a quarter wavelength of transmission line is that when it's slightly shorter than a quarter wave, and it comes off that deep notch of null, it is a great big shunt capacitor. When it's a tiny bit longer than quarter wave electronically, it is a shunt inductor. So once you accept the fact that a little bit above or a little bit below quarter wave will produce any capacitor or any inductor value you want, you've suddenly arrived at the right place. So the stubs will all look the same to the unaided eye. A guy holding a ruler alongside is either going to see a slightly different length, whether or not he wants an inductor or a capacitor, or a significantly different amount of capacitance. As you overtune the capacitor, you're making it longer, and you're doing the equivalent of making the cable longer, so to speak. So the stubs for the receiver side, the stubs for the transmitter side are going to look the same, but electronically they have this difference where electronically they're a little bit above quarter wave, a little bit below quarter wave, at the desired frequency. Over to you, Eric, K2LAW in the TechNet.
All right. Yeah, actually, you can hear what I did on the system itself right now. I'll give you the frequencies on the phone if you want to listen to them. I don't know if you've got any giant-headed capability, but... what I've got to do, I mean, I am in a controlled environment. I mean, the temperature varies in there about 30 degrees, that's about it. So I really don't have to worry too much. But I'm trying, this end that I'm putting together, I have to go up as well. Because with what I set up in Sheldon, actually, I've got a really beautiful bandpass filter where it rolls off, it's a little bit past the receive frequency, but it settles down to like about a minus 100 dB rather quickly and less than megahertz. It's a multi-stage strip line filter. I think it's got like 9 or 10 stages in it. That's why it's got that broad band of this to it. But it works really well. And then I have a really sharp two sets of cavities that I rigged up this little notch system and for the transmit side. And that seems to work quite well at this point. I mean, I can't get any defense out of it whatsoever. K2RWK.
That's sounding very desirable, Eric. For those who want to know what's going on here, for a number of years, the Eastern link on this repeater, 147.375, is tied to the Western link, 146.85, by way of an internet connection. And the internet connection is, on paper, very convenient. But that internet connection has got all kinds of problems of latency. I mean, one day it'll be a tenth of a second delay, another day it'll be 3 seconds of delay. What the internet behaves with the IRLP, I think it is interconnect. You're digitizing on one side and undigitizing on the other side, so to speak, is what's really going on. And so the internet connection, although it's convenient, it's got its problems. Eric is in the process of establishing a real 900 megacycle high security link between the two repeaters. They've got line of sight between the two. And once that link is installed, he's now got all kinds of capabilities of no real time delay, no latency, a hell of a lot higher signal to noise ratio, high fidelity performance and whatever. So lots of benefits will come out of that as the system becomes expanded. And when Eric first mentioned to me, let me drop.
He said.
guy's going to get to you in a second, Scott. When first, when Eric a couple of years ago mentioned to me that he's adding an Echolink, IRLP, and other kinds of things to this repeater so that more people in the outskirts of ham radio, you know, in other states, in other countries, or whatever can sign in. At first, I was horrified. I said, gee, the TechNet already has been going from 2 to 3 to 4 hours each Sunday night. We had more than enough things to cover, and you add more and more people to it. I was scared that, hey, we're going to be going into an overload. Well, we've had significant benefits from doing it. Eric was right, and my original reluctance was wrong. So he's moving further in that direction. Look out. Scott, I imagine you guys up there have got some significant linking between some of your repeaters in the Golden Horseshoe. And so you guys have been down this road and give us a couple of words on what you've done to make it all come out right, Scott. D3ZTZ, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Let me just throw this one thing in here. The reason for the latency is because we like to keep it so that other folks can get into it. So we use a reflector that's in Boston. So the connection is between Glen Oak, Boston, and Selden, and from Selden to Boston to Glen Oak. That's why the path is so long.
Makes a lot of sense, Eric. Wait for the four beeps, and you got it there, Scott.
Echo 3, Zulu Tango Zulu, Scott, Toronto returning. Actually, we don't hear the four beeps through the reflector. We just have to pause and guess. Two things. Jim sent me a text message suggesting I comment on the net that our 6-meter repeater is comprised of 6 quarter wave stubs, 3 per side, made out of 1-inch heliax, and it works very, very well. Unfortunately, the project was done before I joined the club, so although I've seen them and I've been disclosed on them, I didn't participate in the making of them, so I can't provide too much additional information other than they do seem to work on 6 meters at, I believe it's a 1 meg separation. Second point, Eric is building out your RF link. If you shoot him my email, I may be able to give him some additional information on ways to do that if he hasn't already selected the radio components. If you're inclined to do that, feel free to go right ahead and do that. V3ZTZ, back to net.
Good information, Scott. If I go to QRZ.com and type in V3ZTZ, will I find your email address? If not, please give us your email address right now, Scott. VD3ZTZ, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Negative, you will not find it on QRZ, but you do have it in your inbox, so I don't have to put it out on the air. The third thing, if I may, while I still have the air, I'm in the IT field, and I do disaster and business continuation planning for many of my clients, and one of the things that you have to plan for is that in cases of real emergency, the internet will not be there either at all, or it will be crushed under panic and emergency use by the thousands and thousands and thousands of devices. So if your repeater network in any way supports ARES or RACE operations, you're always better if you can to use RF links rather than internet links, because they'll be there for you in emergency, and it's always better to hobby on what you're going to use in an emergency, because that way you know it works day in, day out, and you have broad expertise built up, as opposed to, oh, the internet's not working today, in crisis, what do we do now? D3ZTZ.
Very valuable information. Thank you, Scott. And Eric, yes, I've got some beautiful emails from Scott and Jim. I'm going to mail you a copy of those as soon as the net is over, Eric, so you have the opportunity of seeing what those guys up there in Canada have done, and guarantee you some additional information that might be helpful, so I'll be sending that to you, Eric. Okay, made our promise tonight. Our promise was that within an hour, hour and a half, we go over to the mailbag because some of those guys are high school kids and they can't stay up real late. Well, we didn't make it tonight, but even so, go right ahead, John, with the mailbag. KC2WGV, KQRIW in the TechNet.
Good evening, Paul, Dick,
everyone on the net. Okay, let's see. I have some information that a very kind ham sent to me. Jeff, KC2ZQO. All right, it's about Wardenclyffe. I don't know if you've heard about this. Let me give it a try. Well, apparently, recently, a group that's looking to establish a museum for Tesla purchased Wardenclyffe for approximately $1.4 million. They're going to turn it into a museum, which is going to cost about $10 million, they estimate. So this is going to be something very interesting and a little bit of history. They're going to reestablish his original lab, which is pretty exciting. So that's some news that was good to hear. I don't know if you heard about that, Dick. Over to you.
Yeah, good old Tesla. I believe he, for a short period of time, had a laboratory close to the Thomas Edison Laboratory in Florida, but his main laboratory was out in Setauket, Long Island. I know that the land around it and that particular piece of property was up for sale, and I believe that this particular group you're talking about purchased that one. I'm going to take that laboratory, which used to have this great big tower behind it, which is no longer there, where good old Mr. Tesla was going to try to transmit electrical power wirelessly, a very enthusiastic project back in around 1910 or so is when he was doing that work, not too far from the time when he was establishing three-phase electric power and being the chief designer for the Niagara power system, very successful power system. So I think that's the property you're talking about. The laboratory out in Setauket. Correct me on that one, John. KC2WGV, K2LAW in the TechNet.
Apparently so, Dick. Wardenclyffe was the name of it when he was out there. I don't know if they've changed that area, the name of the area, but that's it. And thanks to Jeff, we have that information. I heard nothing about this, but it's good to hear. And that'll be something exciting to see. All right, let me get the first question here. We'll go on to this. All righty, we have a question here from a young ham who understands how a parallel resonant circuit with a coil and capacitor works. He realizes that one charges the other as it discharges back and forth. His question is, when you have a series resonant circuit, the capacitor and the coil, in series with an antenna, how does it work with no return path, Dick? That's his question, if you understand. If you need more information, let me know.
Yeah, in the case of an inductor and a capacitor in parallel with each other, and people make the mistake of assuming that that equivalent circuit represents an electromagnetic wave, a TEM wave in free space. It does not. So be careful with that one. In the case of an inductor and capacitor in series, you look at it with your oscilloscope when it's being run at its resonant frequency. You'll see a beautiful sine wave across it. At the instant that the voltage of the sine wave is at the peak, positive peak or negative peak, doesn't matter, at that instant of time, all of the voltage is on the capacitor, so to speak, and there is zero current flowing through the inductor at that instant of time. The stored energy in the units of joules, watt-seconds, can be calculated by the formula of joules equals, or watt-seconds equals, one-half CV squared. Take the capacitance in farads, the voltage in volts, square the voltage, multiply the two together, divide by two, that is the amount of energy that's in the capacitor at that instant, and all the energy is in that capacitor at the peak of voltage. Quarter of a wavelength later, the voltage being applied across the capacitor. The capacitor starts drawing current as you cross through 0 volts across that network. At that instant of time, the voltage on the capacitor is 0. No energy is in the capacitor. All the energy is now in the inductor. The amount of energy in the inductor is equivalent to 1/2 LI². In other words, you take the inductance in Henry, the amount of current flowing through it in amperes, square the amperes, multiply it by the Henrys, divide by 2. Now you know the amount of energy in the inductor. Oh, by the way, when the circuit is running at the resonant frequency, the joules of energy in the capacitor...
Repeater, time out.
The joules of energy that are in the capacitor at the peak of voltage and the joules of energy that are in the inductor at 0 voltage just happen to be the exact same number of joules of energy, 1 second of energy. So what's really happening is 4 times per cycle the total energy between capacitor and inductor are bouncing back and forth. From peak voltage, all the energy is in the capacitor, to 0 voltage, and all the energy is in the inductor. That's the first quarter wave. The next quarter wave, the voltage has gone from 0 up to negative peak, from the positive peak, so to speak, all the energy is in the capacitor again. The energy bounces back and forth 4 times per cycle. Crazy circuit, but that's the way it works. When you put the circuit in series instead of parallel, you assume that now the circuit behaves differently. The circuit doesn't know the difference. From the inductor and capacitor's point of view, it thinks the rest of the world out there represents a short circuit. If I got the inductor and capacitor in series, but I take a wire from the output of that network, bring it around back to the input, you've got the short circuit, you've got a parallel network again. You think the series network and a parallel network are a different network. They really are the exact same network. The theory of operation is the same. So, it's now, it thinks the rest of the world is a short circuit. That's one way of looking at it. Another way of looking at it is that when they're in series, you've got a certain amount of capacitive reactance. You can calculate that as a 1/2 pi RC, one over 2 pi FC is the capacitive reactance. The inductance is, one over 2 pi FC, or 2 pi FL is the inductive reactance. It turns out the inductive reactance and capacitive reactance equal each other at resonance. So therefore,
repeater, time out.
I'm pretty bad on timing tonight. Thank goodness I'm listening to what's going on, or I'd be rambling on forever with a machine that ain't repeating me. So the inductive reactance and capacitive reactance in the steady state equal each other. Therefore, whenever you're calculating the total impedance of a series network, in the real world, the inductor has got a little bit of resistance. In the real world, the capacitance has a little bit of equivalent series resistance. Therefore, the complete network is a resistor in series with a capacitor in series with an inductor. That's the real network. And if you want to calculate what is the real impedance of that network, you take the capacitor reactants, the inductive reactants, because they're in opposite signs, you subtract one from the other, and the resistance is all that's left over at resonance. I know that helps a little bit, but it's not the whole story. But you think a series network and a parallel network are two different networks. From one point of view, they're the exact same network. At resonance, the total amount of reactance goes to 0, only the resistance is left over. That gives you a little bit of a hint of why a stub tuner does what it does. Why you want to make the stub tuner out of a coax cable, usually a quarter wavelength long, into an open circuit. You want that coax cable to be as low in insertion loss at that operating frequency as possible, because any insertion loss is the equivalent of a resistance. And for the network to have a reactance that goes to 0, you want the resistance to go to 0. Fancy way of saying you want very low loss cable. Let me drop.
Yeah, could you explain deeper how that power network is connected to the ground, and then it allows a certain frequency to go to the rest of the receiver in comparison to the series?
Repeater, time out. Repeater, time out. Cancel.
Yeah, a parallel network, which is what West is now getting to. The parallel network at resonance is an almost perfect open circuit. So if you've got a parallel network hanging on the grid of your tool, the input network of your receiver, the RF amplifier back in the old days, where you've got an antenna by some means connected to the grid of the tool, and if you've got a parallel resonant network and inductor and capacitor parallel with each other between grid and ground, at the resonant frequency, it's an open circuit. Therefore, your desired frequency flows straight into the tool. All other undesired frequencies represent a much smaller impedance of that network, and therefore they get rejected. You could, if you want to, use both. A parallel LC from grid to ground, or gate to ground, or base to ground, if you know what I mean, making sure that only that frequency goes in. You could simultaneously have a series network between antenna and that parallel network, another L and C in series. The series network is a short circuit at your desired frequency, coupling it from the antenna to the grid of the tube, we'll say. At the same time, the parallel network from grid to ground is allowing an open circuit for that, again, the signal flow through. What we're doing here, step by step, is we're slowly designing a bandpass filter. And you could make a bandpass filter out of a network of parallel LCs to ground, series LCs between them, and you're slowly designing a certain kind of a filter. There are better ways of doing it, but it gives you a little bit more understanding of how the circuit works. Let me drop. But the way we teach filter synthesis and filter engineering in our schools, I know could be done better. The introductory chapters of the Radio Options Handbook do a medium good job of teaching you filter theory. Some of the really good books on the subject are Mattai, Young, and Jones. There's a book that was published by, I think, McGraw-Hill way back in 1950 or so. Mattai, M-A-T-T-A-I, Mattai, Young, and Jones. You Google those words, you get a copy of that particular book. That, and also another Russian book, Zarev, I think this is the way you pronounce his name. The Zarev book and the Mattai, Young, and Jones book. If you own either or both of those books, and you start studying filter theory, and you'll see, in the case of Mattai, Young, and Jones, you'll see real physical layouts of the zillion kinds of filters with their performance curves and design characteristics. You study both of those books. If you want to, you can become an expert on filter theory. Let me drop. I warn you, it's not easy. The books are not super clear, but at least it's all there. It's like the New York Times. Don't have to read it all, but it's all there, if you know what I mean. Those books will teach you a lot about filters. There are people who have devoted their lifetime, their electrical engineering lifetime, to filter design, filter synthesis. It's a whole art form in itself. There are times when filters are quite difficult to understand, but they're real, beautiful, easy ways we amateurs can get around that. If you desire a bandpass, a bandstop, or whatever filter between impedance A and impedance B, you're trying to match impedances at the same time you're trying to do filtering. One of the very quick ways to get 16 answers in a row in a millisecond. Let me drop. To go to that beautiful online Berkeley program. You Google the word Berkeley, B-E-R-K-E-L-E-Y, plus filter. You go, or plus impedance match. You Google those words. And up, one of the designs, one of the websites that Google will go to for you is the Berkeley website. You go to that Berkeley website, it asks you, what is the impedance of your signal generator, your source? And you tell it, it is a 50-ohm source with 0 ohms of resistance. Or it's a 50-ohm source with 5 extra picofarads, with 5 ohms of capacitor reactance, or 15 ohms of inductive reactance. You tell it what the source is. You tell it what the load is. My load happens to be 12.5 ohms of resistance. And it's either a 12.5 ohm resistor all by itself, or it's a 12-ohm resistor with 3 ohms of capacitor reactance or 5 ohms of inductive reactance. You tell it what the load is, you tell it what the source is, you tell it what Q you want, and you press go. And in a millisecond, you get 16 answers. You get 16 diagrams with the exact values of the, oh, you tell it what frequency you're operating at, and you give it the frequency in hertz. 144.0 megahertz would be 1.44 exponential 8 hertz. That's what 144. You tell it the frequency in hertz. You give it the source impedance, the load impedance. You press go, you press calculate, and 16 answers come out. A simple L network, a simple pi network, a simple T network, and the inverted L, inverted pi, inverted T. You get 16 answers, and you choose the one that you like the most, and there is a beautiful synthesis for you. You can spend, after you get your bachelor's degree in electrical engineering, you can spend a year learning how to do filter synthesis. You can get the answer.
Repeater, timeout.
As I was saying, you can spend a year with a course in filter synthesis, and that'll give you a lot of good information. You can go to the Berkeley program with nothing but knowing how to run a computer, so to speak, and you can get an answer in milliseconds that gives you 16 separate answers. Very valuable resource from my point of view. You can spend a good fraction of a lifetime studying Mattai, Young, and Jones. Filters themselves are an art form. A guy who really knows how to build filters with practical materials out of copper tubing and out of interdigital filters, out of printed circuits and whatever, out of strip line circuits and microstrip circuits. A guy who really understands how to make filters is an extremely valuable guy if you're doing any real RF engineering, if you know what I mean. So if you decide to learn that portion of ham radio, it's one of the places where it's time well spent, because there's a real need for that, in my point of view. I know that's a lot more than your guy asked for, but maybe it helps a little bit, John. KC2WGB, K2LIW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB. All right, Dick. His question was understanding the series, because he understands when it's in parallel, how the coil can charge the capacitor, and the capacitor discharges into the coil. But now when it's in series with an antenna, that's where he's having the problem. How is it charging and discharging? Okay. Do you say that because of the energy traveling back and forth before it leaves the antenna, is that part of the charge and discharge? If you could just go a little further with that.
Okay. I have a way that helps me understand what's happening with a series LC network. I'll give you my example. It might help some. Assume now I've got an antenna going into my receiver, and I want to make sure that only 144 megacycles is passing. And I make a series and the capacitor, I make a series capacitor, here we go. I make a series network out of an inductor and capacitor, and by the formula 1 over 2 pi square root of LC, I've calculated the right value of capacitor, the right value of inductor, so it is resonant at 144 megs, and I hook it up between the antenna and the input of the receiver. And now, I'm going to give you an example of what's really happening. Assume that the signal flowing down the antenna was big enough, in this crazy example I'm going to give you, so that 1 ampere of current is flowing. Of course that's huge, but I'm just going to use that for an example. 1 ampere of current is flowing in the steady state at 144.0 megahertz. Okay. Assume that my capacitor reactants and my inductor reactants at 144 megs are equal to each other. That's the definition of resonance. And assume that I chose the right size capacitor and the right size inductor, but that just happen to have 1,000 ohm of impedance at 144 megs. So I've got an inductor that's big enough that's giving me 1,000 ohm of impedance at 144 megs. Let me drop. And I've got a capacitor that's got 1,000 ohms of impedance at 144 megs. And for simplicity reasons, I assume 1 ampere of current is flowing. And it's been flowing for a while. The circuit has come up to steady state response. What's really happening? You know that an ampere of current is flowing through a series network. By definition, in any series network, no matter where in the network you measure the current, it will be the same. So there is an ampere of current flowing from the antenna into the network. There's an ampere of current flowing through the inductor. There's an ampere of current flowing through the capacitor. There's an ampere of current flowing into my receiver in this example. And I know the capacitor reactant is 1,000 ohms. the inductive reactance is 1,000 ohms. Now I decide with a real good oscilloscope, a pair of dual probes going into my oscilloscope in the A minus B function, I first put my pair of ideal scope probes across the inductor. Because the inductor had 1,000 ohms of reactance, because the inductor has an ampere of current flowing through it, by definition, the sine wave signal on that inductor, in my example, is 1,000 volts RMS, 1,400 volts peak, 2,800 volts peak to peak. There's 1,000 volts RMS flowing across the inductor because it's got 1,000 ohms of reactance and an ampere is flowing. I then put my oscilloscope probes across the capacitor, the exact same voltage. 1,000 volts will exist across the capacitor, 1,000 volts AC, RMS. The current flowing through the capacitor and the current through the inductor is the same, but the inductor, by definition, is giving you a current lag of 90 degrees. The capacitor is giving you a current lead by 90 degrees. If I now use three scope probes, one across inductor on the left side, one across
repeater, timeout.
I'm using three scope probes. So the first scope probe is on the left-hand side of the inductor. The second scope probe is at the junction between the inductor and the capacitor. The third scope probe is on the right side of the capacitor. And I now got those three channels going into the oscilloscope, and I first look at A minus B on the first channel of the oscilloscope, and I look at B minus C on the second channel of the oscilloscope. This is a real good oscilloscope. Tektronix makes one that will allow you to do this. I've done this experiment. So I'm now looking at the real voltage drop in time across the inductor, and I'm looking at the voltage drop across the capacitor in time, and in my example, both of those voltages are 1,000 volts RMS, AC voltage. But now I've got these two scope displays, I've got the two sine waves on that scope, and I look at them where horizontal axis is time and vertical axis is each of those voltages. And I'll say, wow, look at that. The voltage on the capacitor and the voltage on the capacitor and the inductor are identical to each other, but they're exactly out of phase. At the instant the voltage on the capacitor hits positive peak, the voltage on the inductor hits negative peak. They cancel each other. Ain't that interesting? So, on a series network, you're developing this great big voltage at the junction between the two. That great big voltage is what happens because of the resonance of the network. With a little bit of mathematics, you can calculate exactly what voltage should be there. Because they're exactly 180 degrees out of phase, they cancel. Therefore, from end to end of that network, the voltage drop is zero. Internally, it's huge. That's what's really happening. Not the whole story, but maybe it helps a little bit. KC2WGV, K2RIW in the deck net.
KC2WGV. Excellent. Okay. That should help him out a lot with understanding that. Absolutely. Okay. Let me just read another note here. Let me let it drop.
I want to add something to that one when I get a chance.
Okay. Well, this will be real quick. I know we got Paul waiting in the wings, and it's very late. I just want to let you know that somebody, George, emailed me a thank you for the Berkeley website that you recommended, because he has a 70-foot pine tree, which he placed a number 6 wire vertically from the top all the way down to the bottom, and he's getting excellent results, and he's using it on 3 bands with 2 networks that he switches in and out, and then for the 3rd band, he just uses the wire itself, and he said it's working beautifully. So he wanted to thank you for that website. It really helped him a lot. He did get the 16 different formats, and he found 2 that worked perfect for him.
And that network he had to put at the bottom of that 70-foot pine tree piece of wire hanging there vertically to run on 3 bands could have been an L network. The L network is exactly that series network we just described. Let me go back. Remember I said, in my example, just to understand what's going on, I assume 1 ampere is flowing. My inductor had 1,000 ohms of inductive reactance. My capacitor had 1,000 ohms of capacitor reactance at my chosen frequency, 144. megahertz, and I'm putting essentially 0 volts across the network because it's acting like a short circuit at that frequency. But internally, the junction between the two, there is 1,000 volts RMS with reference to ground. Think about that. If you and I had to design a step-up transformer where I wanted a 1,000-to-1 ratio of voltage in versus voltage out, we would say to ourselves, my goodness, would that be a difficult design. 1,000-to-1 turns ratio, primary to secondary, that drive you up a wall to get 1,000 volts. By the way, that would be 1,000,000-to-1 impedance ratio. Voltage squared is impedance. So if I wanted to take a 1-ohm source signal generator and plug it into a 1,000,000-ohm load, which might be my vacuum tube voltmeter or my digital voltmeter, it happens to be 10 megohms, but let me assume it's 1 megohm, and I wanted to get highest possible voltage sensitivity out of the meter from a 1-volt source, and I built a simple series network. And in that example that I just gave you, it multiplies voltage in the center by 1,000 to 1. A simple inductor and capacitor in series with each other. One of them, I ground one end and I put the signal generator on the other end. At the junction between the two, in that example, I'm getting something in the vicinity of 1,000 to 1 voltage ratio build up. And I didn't have to build the transformer. And it favors one particular frequency.
And by repeater, time out.
And by making the inductor or the capacitor a little bit bigger, a little bit smaller, if my real antenna, my load, happened to be capacitive, because by way of the Brown and Woodward curves, I found out that that particular diameter of wire and that many feet of wire at, we'll say, 40 meters happens to be a capacitive load because it's too short. I couldn't make it a quarter wave long, or I could make it a little bit more than a quarter wave long and it's inductive. Again, the Berkeley program will tell me exactly how to set up a simple LC network, an L network. One capacitor, one inductor can simultaneously give me any impedance ratio I want, as if I'm doing it with a transformer. Simultaneously, it can take the capacitor reactance or the inductor reactance of the antenna and cancel it. It can't get any simpler. One simple L network like that does it. What makes this non-common sense is that all of our normal electrical engineering experience tells us that if I take a potentiometer, it's really a resistive card with a slider in the center, so to speak. The potentiometer always gives you lower output voltage than input voltage. I put 1 volt across my potentiometer, and I look at what's on the slider as I rotate the shaft. Let me drop. I can go anywhere between 0 and 1 volt. It's a voltage divider network. And if you look at any particular setting of that potentiometer, you've got, if the whole potentiometer is a 1,000-ohm potentiometer, and I've got the slider right in the center, I know that there's a 500-ohm resistor from slider to ground, there's a 500-ohm resistor from slider to the top of the potentiometer with that particular setting. It's a voltage divider network, resistive voltage divider network. When I set up a L network, it looks like a voltage divider. I've got an inductor on top, a junction, a capacitor on the bottom, or upside down, and it looks like it should be giving me a voltage divide. When you're really using it, it gives you a voltage multiply. When you stop using resistors for a potentiometer, and you go over to an inductor and a capacitor, instead of getting a voltage divide, you get a voltage multiply. Ain't that handy? And it's got no loss. An L network, I put a watt into it, I will get 0.999 watts of output. And I can get any impedance ratio I want, and I can get any reactance cancellation I want by simply properly choosing that inductor and that capacitor. Once you realize the power of that very simple network, and that the design will be done for you automatically by Berkeley program, boy, that is a powerful network. Very few of us are given that engineering training, and I'm very disappointed about that. KC2WGB, K2LIW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Great information, Dick. That would be something nice to have on my generators. I'm going to have to try that out. But the fellow with the pine tree really found it very successful, and he's having great fun with it. It's working well. It's late. We better get over to Paul.
and hear what's happening with NASA.